Hi everybody, I'm Sheldon Fetty, I'm an alcoholic. And this is like coming home for me. I'm honored and privileged to have gotten to come to Tennessee quite a bit over the last few years. There's a little conference out here that I've gotten hooked up with and have gone to a couple of times, and my friends from The Usual Suspects are out here, and for them, I just want to say, huzzah! Had an amazing time since I got here. Amazing. We got to go to Nashville downtown this morning, and I'm not surprised so many of you guys are alcoholics. I live in Las Vegas. I live in the Sin City, one of the entertainment capitals of the world. 24 hours a day, anything you want, anything you need at any time. And we do not have a full band playing honky-tonk at 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, how do you stay sober in this place, for crying out loud? I've been sober since July 17th of 1996, and for that I'm very, very grateful. My home group is Connect the Dots in Las Vegas, Nevada, and if you're ever in Las Vegas, I invite you to come to our home group. I'm really proud of my home group, And then we also have a meeting at my home as well, and you're invited to that meeting. So if you find yourself, we meet a lot. We have meetings Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We take Thursday off for some reason. I don't know why, but if you find yourself in Las Vegas, come hang out with us, please. So I'll tell you a little bit about me. I was born in the north of England. I don't sound like that now. I moved to California when I was 16 years old, and I've been in America for a long time, and you guys have kind of worn off on me. My accent's gone away. I believe that it's because I'm a chameleon. All right? I have the ability to just fit in anywhere I am. My brother says it's because I have no personality of my own. I think he's probably right, but I was born in the north of England, a town called Leeds, about 200 miles straight north of London, and I was born to an average family. My mom will never finish her second glass of wine. She's not an alcoholic. My dad told me once that he'd gotten drunk twice, but it seemed to spoil his enjoyment of whatever he was doing. What do you say to that, right? Okay, Dad, you know what? So if being born to alcoholic parents somehow increases your panache here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I fail miserably on that count. Now, my dad did leave when I was very young. I was 2 years old when my dad left. And we had grown up, when I was born into a very middle-class family. We're a Jewish family in a Jewish neighborhood. Typical cookie cutter neighborhood. But when my dad left, we moved into Section 8 housing and we became a welfare family. And I hated my life and I hated my dad because my dad left. That was his fault. I hated him. Mom would scream and yell a lot. I hated my mom. Living with her was a nightmare. That was awful. I hated being Jewish because we're now living in a non-Jewish neighborhood and there's a lot of anti-Semitism in England at the time. And I hated feeling all that prejudice. I hated that. I'm short. I hate being short. My son likes to remind me all the time that the average male is 5'9" and I'm 5'8", which means I'm short. And I'm fat. I'm short and fat and I'm ugly. I mean, I hate my mom, I hate my dad, I hate my brother, and I hate me. And if I knew you, I didn't know you, but if I knew you, I'd have hated you too. Right? I'm 9 years old. I'm 9 years old, and this kid, Barry was a couple years older than me. He was 11, which instantly meant he was cool. Barry said, "Do you want a drink?" Now, I'd have done anything Barry wanted to do, because I wanted Barry to like me. In hindsight, I'm pretty glad that Barry wanted me to drink, right? Because who knows what direction my life would have taken, right? But he did. He wanted to drink. And so Barry said, let's go to this liquor store, this off-license. We'll get somebody to go in and buy us something to drink. And we'll go in this wooded area and we'll drink this drink. And that's what we did. And we stood in front of this liquor store until somebody was willing to go get us a bottle of Old English apple cider. It's like apple juice with a kick, right? And we take this stuff into this wooded area, and Barry's Mr. Cool, and he opens up this bottle of Old English apple cider, and he takes a big swig off of this bottle, and he hands it to me, and I watched what he did, so I did what he did, and I took a big swig off of that bottle, and what happened next was going to happen to me almost every time I drank, from that day until the day that I took my last drink. I puked out of my nose. Because I'm a nose puker. Some of you guys are really good at drinking large quantities of alcohol, right? Some of you guys, you're the carry the bottle of vodka in your back pocket. I'll drink you under the table, four cases a night. You real men and women, right? Right? When you drink someone under the table, I'm already there. And I've been there for a while. Welcome to Under the Table. If being able to drink large quantities of alcohol sometimes is the qualification for being an alcoholic, I fail at that too. Our big book says that when we drink, we are often dangerously and disgustingly alcoholic, right? Some of you guys are dangerous when you drink. You're tougher when you drink, right? And you do all kinds of things better when you drink. You talk to members of the opposite sex better when you drink. You dance better when you drink. If you're a musician, maybe you play music better when you drink. God help us, right? Maybe you're like Joe and you drive better when you drink. No delusion there, Joe, right? But I'm not Dean. I am disgustingly antisocial. When I drink, I'm the guy that, well, I pee on the couch and hit on your mom. That's it. It is what it is. But I love it. I don't care what you think of my drinking. I love my drinking. I love my drinking. I tell you, I'm 9 years old. I'm in this wooded area, and this is what alcohol does for me, right? I'm this short, fat Jewish kid in a non-Jewish neighborhood whose parents are divorced, and I'm just. And there's nothing about my life that feels redeeming, and I hold down just enough of that Old English apple cider for the effect to start to happen. And nothing really happened. Nothing real happened, but emotionally, inside me, it felt like all my problems got solved. Inside me, it felt like my parents got remarried. Inside me, it felt like I grew a few inches, lost a few pounds, felt like my foreskin grew back.
I just want to make sure you're paying attention, that's all. A little later, I might say something important. Not yet, you understand. But a little later, I might say, so I just want you to make sure that you're... I'm ashamed of that joke. I want you to... Not ashamed enough to stop using it, but I'm ashamed of it.
But it felt like when I took that stuff inside me, what it felt like was that all my problems disappeared. And that's what was going to happen to me every time I drank, from the day that I started drinking to the end of my drinking. Beverage alcohol does something for me that is indescribably wonderful. It fixes me in places that I did not know were broken. You know, I was at a conference one time, and some guy said, and I know why he said it. It's a misquote out of the book, right? But what he said was, he said that his worst day drinking, the worst day of his drinking, was better than the best. I messed that up. Right?
if you can edit that last little, just fix that for me. The worst, his worst day in sobriety, right? His worst day sober, his worst day in Alcoholics Anonymous was better than his best day drinking. And I'm wondering, what were you drinking? I mean, if it didn't do nothing to me, I wouldn't have kept doing it and letting it do something to me, right? Because it was magical. I remember, and I'm like Joe, you know, and perhaps one or two of you, I shouldn't do drugs. It never stopped me, but it's clear that I shouldn't do them. And I was at a Grateful Dead show. Yeah, baby. The suspects think they're my people. The deadheads, they're my boys, right? But I'm at a dead show in Shoreline Amphitheater just outside of San Jose, California, and this is probably in 87. And I'm at the way back of the amphitheater. It's a steep amphitheater. I'm on four hits of window pane, and the band is playing, and Bobby Weir yells out, "It looks like rain," right? And then the thunder cracks, and there's lightning, and I'm having a spiritual experience, the likes of which no 12-step call has ever produced. If it still did that, I'd still be doing it, right? And you know, I love Kent's talk this afternoon, and I was hurting a lot of people. And I hate to say it, because selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. But if it still felt like that, I'd still be hurting them. I wouldn't have been able to find the footing in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to find, that enabled me to find the power greater than myself, that enabled me to stay sober one day at a time. It would have been impossible. Because it was so magical when it worked, and it was so fantastic when it worked. But it didn't work for long, right? By the time I'm 21 or 22 years old, what's happening is the consequences of my drinking far outweigh the joy that I'm getting. Now, that doesn't mean that I can stop. If I were a normal drinker, even one that's a heavy drinker, if I was a guy, a typical guy, somebody that maybe drank too much, got in too much trouble, liked it a little bit more than he should, when the concert, I might even get in trouble. Might get a DUI, might lose a job, might even lose a marriage. Might get arrested, might have all kinds of... But at some point I'm going to go, you know, this is just silly. I should probably knock this off. And I would have. But here's what I did. I said, you know, this is just getting silly. I should probably knock this off. And I didn't. And I didn't because of something that happens to me in a state of abstinence. See, I got two things wrong with me. I got a physical allergy. I have a real problem in my life. When I take beverage alcohol, or as I love what Kent says, or any of its cousins, into my system, something lights up inside of me that doesn't happen to the average normal drinker. Something lights up inside of me that says to me, I'm going to have more. I'm just going to do that. I get it in me. I light the fire, and the fire gets out of control, and it gets out of control every time. And it's not a little fire. You know, it's a four-alarm fire. You get the helicopters dumping the stuff out of the local lake kind of a fire, right? I burn my life to the ground, and I can't stop. But it always, at some point, I get stopped. At some point on every runner comes to an end, and usually it comes to an end because I run out of money, right? That's the typical way that it stops. 9 out of 10 runners for me stop because I run out of money. The other 1 in 10 stops because I get arrested or I get beaten up or I get thrown out or one of the dramatic things happens that happens to guys like me. But here's something I've never done. I've never, halfway through a runner, gone, you know, I think enough's enough. I've never chosen that I'm going to stop the runner. The runner always gets stopped, but I always stop at some point. And I wake up with, as it says in the book, and as either Joe or Kent
talked about remorseful. I wake up with a firm resolution not to do it again, right? Feel the shame, guilt, and remorse. That's how I wake up. And I swear I'm never going to do that again. Why would I? It makes no sense. If you lived in my life and had the consequences that I have, you would never drink again because it makes no sense to drink again. I'm not going to drink again. No way, sir. But I got this other thing wrong with me. I got what the doctor calls, when I'm in a state of abstinence, I get restless, irritable, and discontent. What happens to me when I stop drinking is the world doesn't feel like it fits me anymore. It feels like the clothes are too tight, like I'm restricted in my movement. It seems like all the bright and vibrant colors kind of drain out of the world, and I'm looking at a black and white picture. It just feels like everything's too hard, too heavy, too thick. It just feels like I got a knot in my stomach, and I got noise in my head. It just feels like this world is just a difficult, and I just can't, you know what I mean? I just get that, I was thinking today when Kent and Joe were doing the workshop, and you guys did an amazing job. Thank you for that. And Joe was talking about that first step, the way that it's written, that I'm powerless over alcohol, dash, that my life is unmanageable. And he said that, like many of us, and I agreed with him, I was right there with him, that he read that first to say that I'm powerless over alcohol, and because of that, my life is unmanageable. And I had something occur to me. That if you wanted to do that, what you would have to say to tell the truth is this: my life is unmanageable, and because of that, I'm powerless over alcohol. That is really what step one looks and feels like to me. My life is unmanageable. In a state of abstinence, sober, with nothing in my life, with no God, no steps, no sponsor, no AA, no commitment, no nothing, but just on my own, on the natch, my life is so painful, so uncomfortable, and I don't care what it looks like. I get sober. This might surprise you, but I can run my mouth well enough to get a job. Right? I could talk myself into just about anything, right? But I can't keep them, right? So what happens to me is that I get sober, forced into a state of absence. I go out, get me another job. Get a job's a good job. Usually a good job, get a job. Now I got a job, right? I go get a job, I get a job, get a check, get a check, get a check, get an apartment, get an apartment, got an apartment. Was homeless, was jobless, now got a job, got an apartment. This happens in like 3 weeks. Got a job, got an apartment, get a car, now got a car. Now I'm 22 days sober, got a job, got an apartment, got a car. You think my life's doing well. You think that, oh my God, he's on his way. This time he's going to make it. Right? But I can't stand myself. So day 24, I got to have a drink. I got to have one. And I'm telling you, I'm not trying to destroy my life. My goal is not self-destruction. But what happens to me is that in a state of absence, I get so that I think to myself, I'm going to go have a drink. I'm just going to have, I get it. But I can't feel like this. So I'm going to go have a drink. I'm just going to have one. I'm going to have one, maybe two, no more than two, right? One, maybe two, three at the most. No more than four. I'm going to have one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four. That's all I'm going to have because I just got to take the edge off. I just got to take the edge off. I go out, I have one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four. And what happens is that phenomenon of craving kicks in and all bets are off. And the cycle is repeated over and over and over. I am the I did it again guy. That's who I am. I did it again. I can't believe I did it again. I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 25 years old. I'd lost a really good job. When I was a kid, I was a fairground pitchman selling Ginsu knives. But wait, there's more. And I did pretty well at that, and I ended up as a national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances on QVC and Home Shopping Network, and we had infomercials that ran. And I was very, very young to have that job. I was 22 years old, and they fired me from that job. Now, when they fired me, I knew why they fired me, right? Because we always know, right? There was a guy there called Bernard. Bernard was prejudiced. He hated Jews, right?
they said that they thought it was inappropriate to have an alcoholic crackhead as their national spokesperson. Got another good job, lost that job. And I couldn't get any more good jobs after a while. And I show up at a halfway house, and I go to a detox, then a halfway house, and I'm 25 years old. I come out of that halfway house after about 30 days in there. And what happens to me now is the worst 3 years of my life. Because what happens to me now is that I'm getting sober to get loaded, to get loaded, to get drunk, to get sober, to get drunk, to get sober, to get loaded, to get sober. I could typically stay sober on my own with all of my willpower about 10 days. What happens is that I'm in Southern California, and I don't know what your meetings are like here, but in Southern California, typically they're an hour and a half long with a break in the middle. I'm the guy that leaves at the break and gets drunk. I might leave at the break, go out to my car, have a little drink or something, and then come back for the second part of the meeting. Way more relaxed than spiritual, by the way. I might stay sober for a little while, just like this, you know. And I did get 30 days twice, and I lied about 60 days once. but on average, about every 10 days, I would get drunk. About every 10 days, it would get on me so much, so hard, so tight that I just couldn't stand it. So much, and I just had to go. And I go in and out and in and out and in and out, and my life's spiraling in the ground. And I'm doing things that I swore that I would never do, and I'm living in ways that I swore that I would never live, and I can't stand the way my life feels, and I'm starting to fantasize about killing myself. And not because I'm suicidal. Again, Kent and Joe this morning, same thing. Not because I'm suicidal. I wish I had the nerve. I would, like Wilson says, when he would stand in front of the medicine cabinet and curse himself for a coward because he couldn't take the poison. I'm that guy. I'm the guy driving down the freeway in my car wishing that I could slam the wheel into the abutment, but I don't have what it takes to do the right thing, to jump off this merry-go-round that I'm living on. I don't have what it takes. I am not wired that way. I am top of everything. On top of everything. And I've got stories about what a loser I am for days. And on top of all of those stories, I'm a coward on top of it. I don't have what it takes to do the right thing. I'm depressed. The party's over. And I can't stop. And the drinking doesn't even really work anymore, but that doesn't seem to change anything. I seem to have this fantasy in my mind. It seems like that the most fun I get out of a run at the end isn't the run itself. It's the 15 minutes before the run begins, with the fantasy and the anticipation that it might feel like it used to. And then it's me by myself in my room, crying over half a bottle and half a bag. And I can't stop. And I can't stop. And I don't want to live no more. And I don't want to live like this no more. And I can't die. And I don't know what to do. I was 28 years old. I figured if I die relatively young, if I die at 58, right, that's 30 years. 30 years of this. I don't know what to do. July the 16th of 1996, as I had done many times before, I prayed to a God that I didn't believe in. And I didn't believe in God. But I prayed to him anyway, because that's the kind of hypocrite I am. I prayed to a God that I didn't believe in. I said, God, if you exist, don't let me wake up tomorrow. I'd said that prayer many, many times. I woke up that next morning and I yelled out to that God that I didn't believe in, the hell do you expect me to do? Listen, this is the South. Some of you guys hear the voice of God often, right? I'm in the spiritual capital. He talks to some of you guys on a regular bit. I don't hear his voice very often, but I heard it that day. Now, it might have been the memory of some old-timer's voice or something bad I ate the day before, but I'd like to think it was the voice of God. And the voice in my head said, you know where to go. Go turn yourself into those good people in Alcoholics Anonymous.
I got up that morning, I went down to the local AA club where I'd been 100 times before. And I walked in that place feeling more dead than alive. And I sat down in judgment row at the back of the room. Arms folded. Giving you the don't come near me look. And then wondering why nobody's coming near me. The funniest thing in the world, newcomers, right? This is me. I get this look on my face. And if somebody does talk to me, I go, you know what I hate about AA? It's so clicky. Nobody wants to come and talk to the new guy. I'm sitting in that room and I'm there to wait. If you'd have asked me why I was there, I'd have told you I'm here to wait. What are you waiting for? I'm waiting to go get drunk. What do you mean you're waiting to go get drunk? Well, it's what I do. I get drunk. But why are you doing that? I don't know. But it's what I do. I'm that guy. I get drunk again. That's what I do. I'm waiting to get drunk because that's what I do. When are you going to get drunk? I don't know. Maybe in 5 minutes. Or maybe in 5 days. Or maybe in 15 days. I don't know. But I'm going to get drunk again because that's what I do. I do it again. Why? I got no answer to that question. I am a baffled lot. I have no clue why I drink again. I just do. They say in the Eastern philosophies that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And as if by magic, noon meeting, 4 days sober. Guy comes to the noon meeting that doesn't usually go to that meeting. Guy goes to that meeting that he doesn't ever go to. And he shared. And this is what he talked about. And I know it would have been talked about before. I just wasn't ready to receive the information. But he said something like this. He said, you know, I know that I got a drinking problem and I know I can't stop drinking. I know that. I know that because everybody's been telling me that my whole life. I dig it. Drinking's the problem. But drinking's not really the problem. Because if drinking was the problem, I'd be able to quit. What the problem really is how I feel in a state of abstinence. And I can't stay stopped because of the way that it feels for me to be in this world. I'm alone, surrounded by people that I know love me and my family. I'm angry at everybody, even for no good reason. I'm short-tempered. I'm on edge. I'm full of angst. I'm twisted up. Drinking's not the problem. Drinking's the solution. The problem is I can't control the solution. And I heard him. I went up to that guy, and I did not go up to him humbly asking him to help me because I wasn't capable of that. I went up to him almost like a challenge. And I said, man, either you're full of crap or I need your help. To which he said, I will be your sponsor. Next month on the 17th of July, that man will have sponsored me for 21 years. He's still my sponsor today. That man took me by the hand and led me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me on a journey. You know, it's a funny deal. If he hears me talk like this, he says to me, you know, Sheldon, this is just not true. God pulled you from the wreckage. I get it. I get guys I sponsor that I would tell them the same thing. It's the process of Alcoholics Anonymous led you to God. If you have a debt of gratitude, that debt of gratitude belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous and to the power that saved us all. But I got to tell you, I dig the party line. Feels to me like that man saved my life that day. He took me through this process. And here's kind of a rough thumb sketch of what that process looked like. We sat down and we talked about step one. And we talked about step one in a way that I could understand. We talked about the fact that when I start to drink, I have no control over the amount I drink. We talked about the fact that what happens to me is that I decide I'm going to have one. I'm just going to have one. Maybe two. Maybe two. Three at the most, no more than four. no more than four. But somewhere between one and four, five looks like a good idea. I used to struggle with the phenomenon of craving because it sounded to me when you were talking about it, you would say things like, you know, the phenomenon of craving is when you drink against your will. Well, it doesn't feel like that to me, right? It might feel like that to you, but when you say that, it sounds like what you're saying is, I take a bottle, I take the top off, I have a couple of swigs, I put the bottle on the counter, then the bottle grows arms and legs, right? And it's a strong bottle, and it throws me on the bar, and then it starts to pour itself down my throat. And the whole time I'm screaming, no, stop it, I'm an alcoholic, for crying out loud. That is not what the phenomenon of craving feels like to me. The phenomenon of craving feels to me like this. I changed my mind. I'm having a drink and I'm not going to have a lot of drinks, and all of a sudden I decide I'm going to have a lot of drinks. Or I don't even decide at all. I just have them. All of a sudden I'm drunk as a skunk with no money in my pocket, and I go, what happened? It's so funny because people say, what happened? I'm like, I don't know, weren't you there? What happened? What happened? I have no idea what happened. But it happened. It happened again. It happened to me. We talked about that. We talked about the unmanageable life. Now, I'll tell you, unmanageable life is very confusing for me. I have spent years with new people trying to explain to them what the unmanageable life means to me today. You know what it's like when I get lost in self and I get short-tempered and frustrated and I can't seem to make things work out. The harder I try, the harder they get. And I've got causing problems everywhere, and I'm just full of angst. And I got this job, and I know it's a good job, but I hate the job, and I know I shouldn't hate the job. And my life is just, I'm in conflict with everybody. But trying to explain that to a guy with a hangover, right, who's never had any sober experience, it's kind of a waste of time. So he talked to me about an unmanageable life in a different way. This is what he said to me. He said, Sheldon, you ever promised you were going to quit drinking before and drank anyway? Well, we just talked about one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four. Okay, that's cool. That's a phenomenon of craving. Have you ever done this? Have you ever quit and you're not drinking no more, and you quit and it's over and you quit and you get a few days sober and the alcohol's out of your system, and you drink again? Well, yeah. I mean, I told you my story about 10 days on average, of 10 days for 3 years. 365 days in a year. It's like 36 and a half times a year. Right? 3 years, about 100 times. About 100 times I swore I would never drink again, got a few days of sobriety, and drank again. About 100. He goes, okay, those 100 times, do they have anything in common? Like every time you did that, was there anything going on that was the same? I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, well, your last drink, for example, the last one you had, why did you drink? Oh, it's easy. Got in a fight with my boss. He said, well, did you get in a fight with your boss every time on those 100 times, and so the problem is you get in a fight with your boss? No. Well, the time before. Why did you drink the time before? Well, that's easy, too. I got rejected by a pretty girl. Thank you. He said, well, every time you drank again, was it because you got rejected by a pretty girl? I said, well, not every time. But more than I'd like to admit. But not every time. So what did they have in common? I don't know. I have no idea what they had in common. He said, I do. I said, well, what's that? Every time you decided to pick up a drink after a period of abstinence, every time and without exception, every time, you were as physically sober as you are right now. Every time. You decided to pick up a drink after a period of abstinence. You are as physically sober as you are right now. Whoever's making decisions for your life is an idiot. And if that person who's making decisions is managing your life, he's asleep on the job. I would say your life is happening to you, not because of you. it sounds like it's unmanageable to me. You can't argue with that. I mean, you know, if you're new, someone asked me this when I was new. So, just a question. What's your net worth? I'm not a net worth this. Well, how much money you got in your pocket? How much money you got? I got 77 cents. How old are you? 28. How long have you been working? Since I was about 18 or younger. 10 years. 10 years. In 10 years, you've saved 77 cents. These are symbols of an unmanageable life, perhaps, for a guy that's new. Now, it changes when you're sober a while. The unmanageability is a different conversation when you're 6 months sober, a year sober, 5 years sober, 20 years sober. The conversation changes, but this was the conversation when I was new. So he gets step one. He says, we got to do step two. Said, can't do step two, can't do step two, not doing step two. Can't do step two, can't do step three, can't do them, not doing them, can't do them. Which is funny for a guy whose life is unmanageable, jumping right back into manager, right? I know what I'm going to do, what I'm not going to do, but can't do them, can't do them. Why can't do them? Can't do them. Simple, can't do them. Can't do them because don't believe in God. Can't do them because I don't believe in God. Not going to believe in God. Don't believe in God. God's a farce and a hoax, and I'm not doing them. He says, so you don't believe in God? He says, no, I don't believe in God. Can't believe in God. See, I grew up in a Jewish home, but it wasn't really a Jewish home. It was really an atheist Jewish home. What that means is that we're Jews, but we know we're wrong. The only people on the planet that are more wrong than us are our crazy Christian neighbors. I just want to point out that some of you laughed at the Jew joke and did not laugh at the Christian joke. If you fall into that category, you have inventory and work to do, but I got hope for you. We're atheist Jews. We did the ritual stuff, but there was no God in the home. My mom would say things to me like, she'd say, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses. It's for fools and children. Now get dressed. We're going to temple. I actually grew up in a religious sect of Judaism, an Orthodox Hasid sect. Not full Hasid, but an Orthodox sect of Judaism. And in my you could not drive your car on Saturday. No way. No way. The temples didn't even have parking lots. And you'd see all these Jews, I call them five-mile Jews. The five-mile Jews, because the temple was 5 miles because of urban sprawl from our house. These five-mile Jews would get up early on a Saturday morning, and they would walk 5 miles to the temple. We would take the bus to 2 blocks away, make ourselves look tired, and then show up, because we were two-block Jews. I belong to the two-block Jew sect of Judaism. Oh, boy. I'm really glad that Jews don't really believe in hell, because if we did, I'd be in a lot of trouble. Anyway, right? Anyway. So we grew up in this, but I can't believe in the Jewish faith. It felt weird and empty to me, and I got this teacher when I was in middle school, and he was he would get physical with me. I was a tough kid, and he would get physical with me, and he represented Jewish authority to me, and I turned my back on the religion because of him. We had another guy, a reverend, who ran the musical program and who was the chazan. He ran the religious education at the school, and the reverend got in trouble for messing with little girls and boys in the choir. Right? To Catholics, you're not the only ones, right? We're united. We both wear the silly hats, right? We're united. We're united, right? And I hated him for that. Now, I don't know to today. I've done inventory, and I'm not sure today if I hated him because he was a pedophile and he messed with little girls and boys, or if it was because he didn't mess with me, and it was my first rejection.
still not sure, right? I'm working through it. I'm working. That's worse than the foreskin joke, isn't it? Yeah. We're reaching new levels of insanity, right? But anyway, right, so I can't do that faith. But because I grew up in that home, I can't do a Christian faith either. You can imagine if you were trying to get sober in a Muslim country, for example, right, with the religion of your childhood and the faith and the beliefs that you have today. And they said in that room, God as he may express himself in our group conscience. You'd know who they meant. And you'd feel like you were left out and you were alone. We have to be very careful not to bring our own personal faith in Alcoholics Anonymous, because we don't know who's listening. This has to be a... this has to be a safe place for everyone. And my own personal selfishness, because I think I have the right to say something that might be detrimental to the new person coming in because of my selfishness, is just inappropriate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me step off my soapbox. So anyway, I tell them I can't do God, can't believe in God, there's no way I can do God. Can't do two, because I'm not coming to believe in nothing that you're talking about. Can't do three, because I can't turn my will, I can't do it. So he says, let's look at the big book. I say, okay, let's look at the big book. And he takes me to the big book, page 47, in the middle of page 47, it says, when it comes to step two, it says we need to ask our new man one simple question. And the question is this, do I now believe, which I don't? No. I don't believe in God. Stop asking me if I believe in God. I don't believe in God. He said, you don't believe in God. I said, no. He said, okay, it's a comma, not a period. Can we read the rest of the question? Sponsors using that psychic, you know, Jedi force nonsense, right? Do I now believe, which I don't, or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? What does that mean? Am I even willing to believe? Am I even willing to believe that maybe perhaps there might be a God, as unlikely as I think it is? I mean, if you ask me to make a decision now, the answer is no, I don't believe. But am I willing to believe that there might be one? That it's possible, like in the grand scheme of things, like maybe, perhaps, possibly, I don't know, I suppose, no, yes, I don't know, it's confusing. Am I willing to believe that maybe, perhaps, there might be a God? It's unlikely. I mean, let's just state it the way it is. I highly doubt it. It is unlikely, probably not, but I guess I'm willing. Okay, I'm willing to believe that maybe there might be a God. Possibly. He reads on. As soon as a man can say that he does believe, which I don't, or is willing to believe in a power greater than himself, we emphatically ensure him is on his way. What does that mean, emphatically? Like, yeah, baby, you're done. Step two, in the bag, safe. So, if you are in the room tonight and you're struggling with step two, we just all did it together. Struggle over, right? What do I do now? What do I do now? Say the prayer. Say the gosh darn prayer. Say the prayer. Write the list. Say the prayer, write the list. I don't want to write the list. You know why I don't want to write the list? Because he handed me one of those yellow notepads. You know the one. You ever watch that show, First 48 Hours? Right? And they get the guy, the good cop, bad cop, right? They get the guy in the corner and they get the guy to... and they say, you know, you'll feel much better if you write it down. And they slide him the notepad, right? And you're thinking, no! Lawyer up! Lawyer up! I want to ask my sponsor, can I get representation before we do that? They might as well write resentments across the top of that thing before they slide it to the guy. Say the prayer, write the list. Say the prayer, write the list, share the list. Write it and share it. Let's go through the process, shall we? Let's go through the process. Six and seven, don't worry about those. Nobody understands six and seven.
8 and 9, very expensive.
When you're broke and you live in a halfway house and you owe $40,000 to people you don't even like and your sponsor says you need to make amends financially to all of them, it's just like scratching your head going, I made a mistake, I get the wrong sponsor, right? Is there a sponsor out there that says that they should forgive me because God loves me? Can I get that guy, right? He says, they don't want your money. Oh, thank God. Oh, so they want their money back. Ten and 11. Now, 10 and 11 are kind of confusing steps. Half the people in the room tonight think they're doing 10 when they're really doing 11. Now, some of you are nodding. Those of you that are not nodding, get with a nodder after the meeting, and I swear to God, this will be your experience. Really? It does say that, doesn't it? It does. It does. It says, really? Well, I don't care. I'm still calling it step 10. And then start helping new guys. You go through this process and you have the experience like I've had and like I know many of you have had. And I know some of you guys really well and I'm certain you've had that experience too. You have the experience that I've had and you don't have to tell me to carry this message. I dare you to try and stop me. You couldn't stop me if you tried. You tie me to a chair and lock me in a room when the guy brings the food. I'm going to go, hey, by the way, you ever get in trouble from your drinking? We get this process called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really very, very cool, right? But the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I wanted to have a spiritual awakening as the result of steps I'd never taken. Right? That was my problem. I wanted to have a spiritual awakening that is the result of, but that's not unusual. I want to get paid for work I haven't done. Right? First thing I do when I get a new job is ask for an advance. Right? Let's talk about vacation time. You haven't started yet. I know, but I got this thing coming up. Right? I mean, I'm just that guy, right? I want to get paid for stuff I haven't done. And I want to have a spiritual awakening as a result of steps I never took. Right? But that's what the whole point is here. If you're like me and you're struggling with this God concept, all Alcoholics Anonymous is, in its most simplest form, is a place for a guy like me that feels alone to find people that will be nice to him long enough for him to do the work to find a way for him to get connected to a power greater than himself that will help him stay sober one day at a time, and then some new guys he can brag about it to. Right? And that's what we do here. We do the AA hokey cokey. We come in here and we put our left foot in and we shake it all about. Right? And if we're lucky while we're doing the dance, we get to find someone to help and we find this light. This warmth, this glow, this spirit, this thing inside us that was dead gets brought back to life. Went through this process with my sponsor. And I'm not, Bill Wilson, page 14 of the big book, mountaintop, clean wind through and through, right, the whole white light experience. Now, if you want to have one of those, you got to read page 13. It'll blow your mind what's on that, right? But you read page 13, Wilson does page 13, then page 14 happens. He had an immediate, overwhelming God consciousness after he went through the process to remove the blockage from him and God, right? I had some pretty neat effects. When I did my fifth step, I felt, whoa, this is kind of cool. I made my first nine step, and I was like, wow, this is kind of cool. But I didn't get lit up with the Holy Spirit right away. It didn't happen for me that way. Slowly what happened was I got off the debating team. I stopped arguing with people about God, right? And I just kind of kept quiet. And I would say God, and I didn't know what I meant or who I meant, but I just got off the debate. This took a while. The newcomer, I don't mean to scare you. It's just my experience. I was about 4 or 5 years sober. 6 years sober. And I'm driving up to my sponsor's house for a Tuesday night meeting that I'm a regular attendee of. And for no reason and out of the blue, I started to cry. Just a little tear.
that's odd. That's odd. I thought, what's that tear about? As I started to think about that tear, I started to leak. I mean, snot bubble leak. Like you would think somebody just shot my puppy leak. But I wasn't sad. I wasn't sad and I wasn't unhappy. I was overwhelmed with something inside me that I just blew my mind. And it was just this. It's true. It's all true. The power's true. The mystery's true. AA's true. It's just true. And what blew me away more than anything was that it was not a new thought. It was not like, oh my God, I just figured it out. It was like, you know what? Not only is it true, it's been true for a while. I'm just so self-obsessed I hadn't noticed. Right? But it was real. It was real. And God was there. And the God that I have in my life today, I get very confused by. He's not a Jewish God. The Jews tell me I'll always be a Jew. Right? It's great. It's not my faith. I'm not a Christian. I'm not in anything. Here's what I am. I'm a guy that's absolutely convinced that there is a power out there that is bigger than me, that has done something in my life that was so amazing, so miraculous, so impossible, that I just want to talk about it. Right? Because a broken human being came in here, and I'll tell you this, I do not subscribe to it. In fact, I challenge the idea that because I'm an alcoholic, I'm a scumbag and always will be. I'll tell you what I am today. I am a loyal, faithful husband to a woman for 20 years because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am the father of a 15-year-old child that if I ran at him screaming today, would not run away from me because he knows I'm not going to hit him. He loves his father and I love him and we are best friends. I'm a great employee. I get promoted at the jobs I get, and they throw more money at me. I'm a great employer. I'm in the middle of starting a new adventure, and guys that used to work for me are calling me, asking me to come and work for me. I'm a member of my community where my neighbors know that my house is not going to be the problem on the block. The police don't have to worry about me. If I come into your home, you don't have to hide your valuables. I'm not going to hit on your wife or your mom. And I probably won't pee on your couch. And none of those things are true because of anything about me. They are true because AA works. It takes broken people and fixes them. If you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're sober a little while and you're still acting like the bandit you were, I love you. But get a sponsor, take the steps, change your life, bring God inside of you, and join the procession of people that Alcoholics Anonymous is saving and changing their lives. Because it is an amazing journey, and it's true. It's true. I'm going to tell you a little story about my folks for a minute. Step four, my dad is the first name on my list. I hated my dad. I hated my dad because my dad left when I was 2 years old, and I'm resentful at my dad. What's affected what did he do? He left. What's affected everything, right? Financial security, emotional security. I mean, even when you get the emotional disturbance of growing up, that back then when he left, divorce wasn't chic, right? I was laughing. My son, and it's a shame, but it's the reality. My son, right? They say to him at school, "What do you mean you only have one bedroom in one house?" All right? But back then, when somebody was divorced, it was taboo. It was, and we were out, and I hated him because he did that to me. My dad did that, and I hated him. My mom was a screamer and a yeller. My mom was unpredictable. My mom, little lady, not violent, but emotionally could be very tough, and I hated my mom. They're the first two names on the list. If you're new and you've never written an inventory, by the way, we could do it for you, right? Seriously, we don't because it's fun to watch you squirm. But It typically goes, you know, dad, mom, current spouse, siblings, current employer, previous spouse, previous employer, previous, and then trickles down to anyone that's had any insignificant contact with you, your entire pathetic little life. On my resentment list was the lunch lady from third grade. I think I was 7 or 8 years old, right? The way she went was offensive. It was, I was 28 when I did my inventory. It was 20 years later, and this was not a small resentment. I hated her. She was, it took a while to get to her, right? But anyway, mom and dad, dad's first sponsor says, what about your dad? And he tries that spiritual mumbo jumbo, you know, we got that. This was, he says, you know, well, maybe your dad did the best for you that he could. You know, with the tools. He had it as a, get new tools. I was 2 years old, get new tools. We talk about my mom. We skipped over my dad. I wasn't having it with my dad. We talked about my mom. And you know, my sponsor read that part of the book. He said, this was our cause. We realized that the people offended us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we didn't like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. And we talked about my mom and what was it like for my mom to be a young divorced woman in that community. What was it like to be her? What was it like? You know, my mom, when my dad left, and we moved out of the middle-class neighborhood into the Section 8 housing, my mom needed to make some extra money, and there was no way she was qualified to get a job that would make a difference with the Social Security and the other money, food stamps that we were living on. So she needed to find a little cash under the table job. And that's just the way that it was, and that's the way that it is for millions of people even today. And she had no choice but to do that. And the only way she could do that was to humble herself and to go to the women who she had gone to high school with and ask if she could be a domestic in their home. I can't imagine the shame and the humiliation of having to do that. I can't imagine. Would that make me a little cranky? Just a little. And how did I react to that? I never imagined what it would be like to be her. I'd be playing with the kids of that home and I'd see her coming. And I'd make an excuse to leave because I didn't want them to see me and my mom in the same room at the same time while she's cleaning their houses because I was ashamed of her when all she was trying to do was to provide a better life for me and my brother. But I was ashamed of her. What would I have done if I was her? I tell you, if it was up to me and my brother wouldn't have been raised the way that we were raised. Life wouldn't have been as good as it was with my mom, with all of her imperfections. With all of her imperfections. Where was I selfish, self-centered, dishonest, or afraid? Everywhere. Everywhere. What should I have done instead? What kind of kid was I? If my mom was the perfect mom, right? Let's just let her off the hook. If she's the perfect mom, what kind of kid am I? I was the worst kind of kid. I took advantage of her size that I was physically able to overpower. I took advantage of her guilt and her shame, and I pushed her and I pulled her and I treated her like crap. I was a terrible kid. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes you hear people misquote the big book and they say, you know, in step four, and in every resentment, you have to try and find your part. I'm not good at that. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm going to... If this was the problem, and I was going to find my part, which one's the part? Right? Nobody needs to point it out. We know which one it is. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we say is putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done. We don't even get to consider what they did. Right? And my sponsor directed me to do that with my mom, and I didn't immediately fall back in love with my mom, but we began a healing. Some cracks in the wall came between me and my mom, and I made amends to my mom, and today my mom and I have a better relationship than we have ever had. Ever had. What about my dad? Well, you know, the truth is with my dad, he said, what do you think it was like for your dad to live with your mom? Do you think your mom changed when he left, or could she have been difficult all along? Could she have handled stress and pressure that way all along? What do you think it was like to be your dad? And we talked about it, and here's what we came up with. Now, what's funny about this is we don't know if it's true. But isn't that what I do anyway? Anybody like me, you get 10% of the information and make up the rest? Right? I do that all my life. I did that today 17 different times, right? I get 10% of the information, and I never make up love stories, right? I always make up action thriller dramas where the hero dies at the end, right? So we all know if this is true, but this is the story. We wrote the story. Instead of my dad being this mean guy that left my mom and my brother and I to suffer, here's the story we rewrote. Because it's possible. It's equally as possible as anything else. Perhaps my mom was really difficult to live with. Perhaps he came. Perhaps they got married, as this is true, very quickly, as people did in that small Jewish community. Even though the Second World War was long since over, there was a lot of prejudice in Europe, and my dad was still forced into the army through conscription, so they married very quickly. Maybe he didn't really know. Maybe after they got married, he discovered things about her that made them not compatible, neither good nor bad, but not compatible. Maybe he came home one day and she said she was pregnant and he was getting ready to leave, but he did the honorable thing and he stayed as long as he could. He just stayed. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe in about 2 years after that, when that kid's getting out of diapers and that kid's, you know, able to be taken care of and all it would take is a little money to make her life easier, he was getting ready to leave again. And then she said, "I'm pregnant again." And I came along. And maybe he stayed as long as he could till he couldn't stay no more and he couldn't stand it no more. And he just did the best he could, but then he left. And when he left, instead of staying in town, I wanted him to stay in town. I thought he should stay in town. But instead of staying in town, what he did was to protect her reputation, her pride and her ego. He left town so she could call him the bad guy and he didn't have to defend himself. Maybe he left and went as far away to give her the space and peace that she needed. Maybe he abandoned his brother, two brothers that he'd never see again, he'd see him again but not live in the same town. His parents, who he'd never live in the same town. Maybe he walked away from his kids at the pain that it must have caused him. I'm a father now, I know that pain. Maybe he did all of those things to give mom the best chance at a dignified life. Maybe that's what happened. I don't know. But I'm wrong so often. There's as good a chance of that as any other, and that's the story I told, and I started to let my dad off the hook. You know what I never, ever considered? Was that my dad had the right to any happiness. I made a decision when I was a child that my father should have, and I never articulated this, but I tell you, I acted like it. My father should have had a miserable, sad existence with no more joy. He should have suffered in a marriage he wasn't happy with, in a town he didn't want to live in. He should have stayed with us at whatever personal consequences, because once he had sex with my mom, he never deserved any more joy or wasn't entitled to any more happiness ever again. Amen. I want you to know that I think stuff that I don't say. Right? It's not like I really say everything I think. Trust me, there are lines that come up and I go, no. So I start to let my dad off the hook and my dad comes back in my life. My dad is a rascally rabbit and a scoundrel. He just is. I love my dad. And he's a rascally rabbit and a scoundrel. And we got involved in some business stuff together. And, well, he got me. And then right after he got me, or in the process of getting me, he met a girl in England and he decided to move back to England. And my son was in love with him. My son was about 6 years old at the time. He was in love with his grandfather. He left me when I was two. Now he's leaving my son, his grandson, when he's six, and I hate my dad, and I got so angry at my dad again. And then he took that money. He didn't really take the money, but he made decisions based on self that put me in a position to be hurt. Right? And you can screw with me, and you can screw with my wife, and you can screw with my son, and there's consequences, but if you mess with my money, it's a completely different conversation. They're replaceable. We're talking about money here, right?
Don't let Jackie hear that, Lee. It's another little edit for thank you. You're on my side, right? You got me? All right, So he moves back to England, and I hate him, and I go to my sponsor, and I'm so angry, and I tell him, you know what? You let him get me again, and it's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault. You keep driving me to get close to him, and I hate him. And I'm telling you, I'm so angry, I can't stand it. And you know what? That money? I think you owe me that money, right? I think it's your goddamn fault, because if you hadn't pushed me to get close to him, he wouldn't have got his hand in my pocket. And I tell you, I hate you, and I hate him, and do not tell me to go back and talk to him. Him and I are done. My sponsor says, okay, you can be done with your dad, but I want you to be done with your dad with your eyes wide open, not with them half closed. So let's look at the decision you're making. If you're done with your dad, let's look at the decision. Here's the decision. You're deciding to write your dad out of your life. He's old. He's probably not got much time left, maybe 5, maybe 10 years, but in 5 or 10 years, you will punish your dad for 5 or 10 years, then he'll be dead. But you'll have punished him. Then you, for the rest of your life, will know that you came from bad stock, that your father was no good, that's the blood in your veins, it's the kind of person you are, because you're just like him. And you'll know that, and you'll suffer with that. And when you hear sounds or smells or see things that remind you of your dad, it'll cause you pain. But that's okay, because you're probably only going to live about another 40 years, and then you'll be dead. If you want to suffer with that for 40 years, choose to do it, it's up to you. Now, your son, let's talk about your son, because your son's going to have the same feelings and emotions you have. He's going to know for certain that he comes from bad blood. He's going to have all the bad memories, all that stuff, and he's going to live for probably 70 years, and then he'll be dead, and who are you really punishing? But by the way, one more question, what's that? And when they do that, you know what's coming. It's a good one, right? One more question. He says, let me ask you this. He said, do you think you'll ever let your son down? Do you think you'll ever take any actions that your son will disapprove of? Do you think you'll ever act in a way that might hurt your son? Right? I mean, seriously. I mean, it's just life. And you know what? Have you ever heard a false step that dad's not on it, for crying out loud? I mean, the perfect father ends up on the false step, right? Of course, I will. He said, what lesson do you want to teach your son? Do you want to teach your son that the Fetty men walk away from their fathers when they act badly? Or do you want to teach your son about love and forgiveness? What lesson do you, what example do you want to set for the guys you sponsor? What example do you want to have in this world? Do you want to be someone that forgives in the spirit of God and spirituality? Or do you want to, what do you want to do? Now I've got to make amends to my dad again. And I'm mad at him and I hate him and the phone rings. And he's dying. And he's in England, and I'm in Las Vegas. And in prayer meditation, I get to see the truth. And the truth is that my dad never meant to hurt anybody the same way I never meant to hurt anybody. We're not bad people getting good. We're sick people getting well. And we have no monopoly on sickness. My dad made decisions based on self that put people in a position to hurt people just like I have. My dad never, very few people ever do this, woke up in the morning and thought to himself, how can I hurt my son? I hate him. Just life happened. And he did. I hate this. But he did the best he could with the tools at his disposal. And I knew I had to go to England and tell him I loved him and let him off the hook. But I couldn't say that to him. You know, newly sober I might have, but at the time, I think I was 15 years sober, I would have had to say to him, Dad, you did the best you could with the tools you had at your disposal. It's not your fault. You just weren't man enough to be my dad. And I forgive you. I don't know what that is, but it ain't AA. So I got to find a way to talk to him. And on the flight over, God came to me and I got the answer. And I sat with my dad and I said to my dad, Dad, I got to tell you. I want you to know something. He goes, what's that, son? I said, I want you to know that I'm glad that you're my father. He said, don't be ridiculous. I'm a lousy father. And he was. He was a lousy father. And he knew it. He was a smart guy. But had he not been paying attention, I pointed it out regularly. You're a lousy goddamn father. I said, that's not what I mean, Dad. So, you know, I got to...
I'm just like you, Pops. We're stamp pals. People tell me I have a great sense of humor. You know, Mom, not so funny. It's your blood and your DNA that has created the person that I am today. Dad, I'm a great salesman. It's afforded me a great living. Half of that is because of your DNA, and half of it is because of your training and tutelage. You created the career that's created an amazing standard of living for my family. I love my life, and I'm glad for who I am. And I'm glad that you're my father. I had a realization that I was telling people that the worst thing that ever happened in my life was that my father left. Ask me about my life, I'll tell you. I have an amazing wife, a great son, a great career, an amazing home group. I'm sober in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing about my life of any real consequence that I would change. I have my life for one reason. Because my father left when I was 2 years old. Because if he hadn't left, I'd still be in the north of England in that small town with no sunshine to speak of. And I might have a good wife, but she wouldn't be my wife. And I might have a good son, but he wouldn't be my son. My life only exists today. When my father left, was it the worst thing he ever did? Or was it the best thing he ever did? I don't know, but my life is different had that not happened, and I knew that. And I was trying to tell him that. I didn't say to him, the best thing you ever did for me was leave. It would have been worse than, you're just not good enough to be my dad. But I was trying to express that to him, right? He puts his head down and he starts to cry. And when he lifts his head, he says, son, you know I'm dying, right? I said, I know, Dad. He said, I don't know what happens next. I don't know if I go to heaven or hell or if I just go to sleep, the lights go out. I don't know if it's reincarnation. I don't know what there is. But if it is reincarnation and I get a second shot, I hope I become the kind of man I've watched you grow into in Alcoholics Anonymous. That little 2-year-old boy that's inside of me that's been dying all these years was healed. Do the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do the work. Take the action. Work the steps. Find the process that fits for you. Find someone to take you through the process, and your life will change in marvelous, miraculous, and amazing ways. I am a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a grateful member of my home group. I'm a grateful sponsee of my sponsor and a grateful sponsor of my sponsees. And if you knew, that probably makes you want to puke. But get involved. Do the work. Take the steps. My only hope for those of you that have not yet is that you will find in this program what I have found in this program. Thank you for my life.